Welcome to another edition of Call Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine. This week, as the high season for desserts, also known as the holidays, approaches, a chance for you, our loyal podcast listeners, to ask questions of our pastry wizard, the brave tart herself, Ms. Stella Parks. We figure that serious eaters, sweet fiends, and bakers everywhere would want to learn from Stella's vast experience. The same thing we say about Kenji's knowledge of savory foods goes for Stella and sweets. What she cannot answer is probably unknowable. Stella is also the author of the upcoming Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts, which you can now, as I already have done, pre-order on Amazon. Welcome, Stella. Before we start, though, should we be roasting up some sugar in advance?
We probably should be, but fortunately, it's easy to multitask.
You know, we're referring to a famous Serious Eats post that Stella did about roasting sugar, which turns out to be this astonishing thing that she discovered by accident, right? You discovered it by accident when you were working in a restaurant.
Yeah, the happiest of accidents.
You inadvertently left sugar in the oven.
Yeah. It was a delicious mistake. And no, I do actually always have some on hand because I use sugar as a pie weight. When I'm baking pies, and especially this time of year when you're making a lot of pumpkin pies and pecan pies and that sort of thing, sugar really piles up that way. So it's easy to get a lot roasted in a...
And what happens when you roast sugar?
It lightly caramelizes. So it begins to develop some of those roasty, toasty notes that you associate with caramel, but to a much more subtle degree. And the net result of that is that the sugar tastes dramatically less sweet. And from a scientific perspective, it is less sweet. Its sucrose is being converted into caramel compounds. So it's just fabulous for, especially in things like meringues, if you're going to make a meringue pie, to use that toasted sugar in place of regular sugar just tames down the sweetness dramatically, adds a lot of complexity. And it's a really beautiful thing.
Wow, man.
And we'll be covering that soon on CBC.
Yes, absolutely. So we have our first call. Danica, welcome to Call Special Sauce.
Hi, Stella. I'm a super, super fan.
Hi. Good to hear from you, Danica.
We like to hear about from serious, serious fans. So where are you calling from, Danica?
I'm calling from Atlanta, and I'm a pie baker.
Atlanta, GA, a pie baker.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, first of all, you do know if you read Stella's posts on Serious Eats and my reaction, which has probably not been suitably noted on the site, that Stella is the best pie baker I have ever experienced. And so the fact that you are a pie baker yourself and a pie freak and a Stella freak means that you have
and
arrived.
A Southerner, question mark?
And a Southerner. This is the perfect confluence of circumstances for this call. So what's your question, Danica?
Well, you said something really interesting I'd never heard before, sugar as a pie weight. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, there's a post on it on Serious Eats, so you can go there and go to my profile and find it there for, like, the full scoop. But in short, instead of using something like beans or rice, which are actually very lightweight per cup, I use sugar, and so I line the pie pan the pie shell, the rolled out pie dough, with tin foil, and then fill it to the brim with sugar, which is really heavy at nearly half a pound per cup. It really holds the crust down. It prevents any bubbling along the bottom of the crust. You don't even have to dock the dough. The sugar is heavy enough to hold it in place, and it prevents slumping entirely because, you know, most people have a large bag of sugar on hand, so you don't have to use just, oh, here's my 12-ounce bag of rice that doesn't really even come halfway. You can just fill it up. About 4 cups of sugar will fill it right to the brim of your crust and prevent any slumping or drifting of the sides as they kind of, like, tend to fall in. Because they're top heavy. The rickrack border that you build on a pie crust is inherently top heavy, so it wants to fall in. And the sugar stops that. So
and
it's
then,
my favorite.
And then you inadvertently get a bunch of roasted sugar.
And then you get some roasted sugar. And it's good for, I mean, you can keep using that same sugar over and over again as many times as you like. But even after just one usage, it's significantly less sweet. So it's already perfect. But I do tend to cool it down and bag it up and use it for about 3 or 4 rounds of par baking pies. And then at that point, it's got a deep beige kind of manila color. And it's brilliant. It's so tasty.
So Danica, what are you used to using for weights?
I actually use pebbles or, you know, things like that. So I'm definitely going to try the sugar. I do have another question for Stella.
All right.
Well, Stella, of course, you are brave, and you're the brave tart. A French woman once said to me, a tart is not a pie. Could you definitively explain to us the difference between a tart and a pie?
Oh, I completely agree with the French woman. A tart is definitely not a pie. To me, it comes down to a ratio issue. Let's take a classic French lemon tart and a lemon meringue pie, an American lemon meringue pie. And the difference starts out in the crust. A French crust tends to be a lot richer, and American-style crusts tend to be a little bit more lean and flaky, and a French tart crust also tends to have a short texture, like a shortbread or crumbly kind of cookie dough-like texture. So that's different right off the bat, and a French filling for a tart is going to traditionally be a lot richer, very yolky, very buttery, very intense lemon flavor, extremely tart, whereas an American-style lemon meringue pie is going to be really lean, actually. There's a lot of water in there. It's kind of like lemonade, if you think about it. We want to dilute the intensity of both the lemon and the sugar so that we can have, like, a big fat slice of pie after a meal and not want to, like, kill ourselves afterwards.
Well, you couldn't have a big fat slice of lemon tart.
And so the idea is that you would either have an individual tart that's, like, very small, like, single serving for a person, or you'd make a larger tart and cut a very thin wedge. And a French lemon tart is going to have less meringue. It's usually like kind of like just a curlicue on one end as part of the design, or it's piped on very artfully and then bruleed. Whereas, you know, America's famous for the mile high meringues. We just like we don't even believe in restraint. We're just like going crazy. And these huge, like, you know, mammoth pies with all the meringue on top. And, you know, in a way, it's not that the French are showing restraint. They're just concentrating all of that intensity into a very small serving so that you're still having an intense experience, so I wouldn't exactly call it restraint per se, but it's just a different style. So you can have a very small piece of a tart or a single tart and be quite satisfied with that, whereas we just want a big fat slice of pie.
And then also the mile high thing means that the French can look up their noses to us. Danica, what else is on your mind?
Well, I've already learned one amazing tip. I'd love your tip. Let's go back to American pie, good old-fashioned American pie. The pie crust, what do you do to give it that kind of lovely golden color? What are your best tips?
I'm a big fan of an egg wash.
Okay.
If you're going to have a double-crusted fruit pie. And I use a whole egg plus a tablespoon of cream or an extra yolk, depending on what I have on hand.
Oh, interesting.
Just to enrich it a little bit. There's nothing wrong with just using a whole egg, but the real key to browning is to use a really generous pinch of salt into that mix. And that allows the mixture to brown more in the oven, regardless of what your base is, whether you're using a whole egg or an egg cut with cream or another yolk or something. You really want to salt it quite nicely. And then that adds more flavor, but it improves the browning. I don't use any sugar in my egg wash because I want that savory edge. Usually the filling itself is going to provide plenty of sweetness, so I don't really need to amp that up at all. But a nice hit of like a little bit of something savory with the salt is really nice in an egg wash. And for a single crusted pie, I don't typically use an egg wash, but my crust is pretty rich, so it has a lot of butter in it that wants to brown already. And whenever I blind bake a pie, I bake the heck out of that crust. There's a lot of people like, you know, bake it until it's pale around the edges. I'm like, no, bake it until it was like burnished gold. Just keep going. Because then it's going to get really crispy and nice. And the browning of the butter just lends so much flavor. So I don't have a lot of use for a pale pie crust. So
and do you use any lard?
Keep baking. No, I'm an all butter girl, despite my southern roots. I'm also allergic to pork. So that's kind of an interesting side note that has steered me away from that style of baking.
So speaking of allergies, if you have someone coming over for the holidays and they tell you either in advance, hopefully in advance, that they're gluten-free or have a gluten intolerance, what do you do as a serious devotee of baking and desserts?
So this is actually a really serious question because coming from a background in restaurants and food service and being good friends with the local health department. You know, to me, preparing foods for someone with an actual allergy is serious business, and you can land someone in the hospital. And as someone with, a food allergy, I really appreciate that. So it's not enough just to grab a really solid gluten-free recipe and have at it. You know, you need to speak with your friend and find out the extent of their allergy. Like, is this going to land them in the hospital? Is this going to provoke, a night of pain and misery for them?
Or are they just being neurotic and trendy?
Well, I mean, not even – for example, I am allergic to pork. When I consume it, I get really intense stomach cramps. I get a rash all up and down my arms. And it's not a lot of fun, but it's something that I do choose to experience because I can't live without bacon and pork products. So there are times that, my friends know that I have these allergies, and they also know that I'm willing to go through that. So someone may say, yeah, I am gluten intolerant. It is a problem for me, and I do feel bad sometimes. But, sometimes I'm willing to experience that. Or everyone has a different degree that they're going through. And it's really important to find that out, because it's one thing if someone chooses to take that risk for themselves, and it's a completely separate thing if that risk is, forced upon them.
Right.
So finding that out up front is important. And really detoxing your kitchen if you decide to go through with that for a friend. You want to make sure that you are not, cross-contaminating your baked goods with, that old wooden sifter that you've got where it's, aluminum but wooden around the edge where the mesh meets. Can harbor, flour from previous baking experiences. So you don't want to, or an old wooden spoon or something like that. You want to make sure you use non-reactive tools and equipment that aren't going to be harboring any like hidden gluten. And especially something like a rolling pin, you're going to want to grab a separate rolling pin if you're preparing something for someone who's going to have an allergic reaction or is going to have a painful experience.
And what desserts lend themselves if you're dealing with someone who has a real severe gluten intolerance problem?
I mean, as long as you've got a solid recipe, I have an angel food cake recipe on Serious Eats that's gluten free, and I think it's fantastic.
I've had it. I can attest to it.
So there are a lot of desserts out there that aren't dependent on gluten in the first place. Angel food cake is a great example because you don't want gluten development. You want it to be tender and light and soft. And so, getting rid of the gluten is actually super helpful for a recipe like that. Pie crust is another one of those things where, traditionally people are going every which way to try and avoid gluten development. So a gluten-free pie crust is pretty handy and something like that. Or, there's plenty of desserts that don't even involve flour in the first place, going for a custard or a pudding or something. But at the holidays, we do tend to want cakes and pies.
So Danica, do you is this something that you deal with in your household?
Not in my household, but every so often I'll go someplace where the person's vegetarian, so that obviously lard is out of the question. Gluten free. What I've done is I've done crumb crusts. Found gluten-free cookies and turn them into crumb crusts. I'm just not sure I want to tackle a gluten-free pie crust because, the basics of a pie crust are flour and fat. And speaking of flour, Stella, what is your all-time favorite flour for pie crust?
I am a big fan of Gold Medal. Just classic Gold Medal. And this is something I've actually been working on a post for this for a really long time, and I haven't quite finished it up. But I use bleached flour, and I know there's for a lot of people that's somewhat controversial. There's been kind of a move towards unbleached flour because it's kind of the push for natural and organic. But the problem with that is most unbleached flours are either made from all red wheat or all white wheat, and either one of those kind of lends it an extreme character. If you've got an all-purpose flour that's made from all red wheat, it's a harder wheat. It's a higher protein wheat, so it tends to require some careful handling, or it can get tough. It can, harm the crumb of a cookie or a cake and make it a little bit more coarse. Where conversely, if something is an all-white wheat flour, kind of think of like white lily or something. It can be really starchy, and it can change the how liquids behave in a recipe, so it can stiffen up a batter in a way that you don't want, and inhibit spread or just not give enough protein development. And so the bleached all-purpose flours that are currently on the market are actually blended. It's a blend of red and white wheat. And for me, that hits the perfect balance of starch and protein for, you know, just a really good performance in a flour across the board, whether you're making cinnamon rolls or you're making cupcakes or you're making cookies. It's just like, it's perfect. And by trying to switch to an unbleached flour, what companies do is, because many consumers are still not prepared for the kind of actual color they're going to get, they'll use a soft white wheat that is naturally paler, so they don't have to bleach it. But again, that makes it like really starchy and unpleasant. And then other companies are like, no, we don't care, you know, just embrace the color that it has. And they'll go for an all hard wheat, a red wheat, and it's a lot darker and potentially a lot tougher and can make things a little bit it may make recipes behave in a way that's unexpected if it was developed with a traditional all-purpose flour in mind.
So good old gold medal.
Gold medal gets it. Pillsbury is an excellent, you know, all-purpose flour. And all of my recipes that I do on Serious Eats are cross-tested with Pillsbury and gold medal. I use one in the Serious Eats test kitchen, and I use one at home.
And
that way I've got a chance to, you know, let the recipe kind of experience both major national brands.
Got it.
When you talk about flour, my temptation is to look for the light baking flour. But you're saying just go for good old-fashioned all-purpose.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in all-purpose.
In fact,
all-purpose was a contender title for my book. I wanted to call it all-purpose because that's the heart of American baking is all-purpose flour.
Well, thank you, Danica, for calling. I hope we've answered your questions.
Oh, yes, I'm honored.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for calling. You're listening to Call Special Sauce. Ed Levine here with our pastry wizard, the Brave Tart, the phenomenal Stella Parks. Chris is on the line. How you doing, Chris?
Hey, folks. I'm doing good. How are y'all?
Good. Hey, did you hear that?
I heard of y'all.
You heard of y'all.
Hey, I'm Kentucky proud here.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And where are you calling from, Chris?
I'm calling from Georgia. While I'm Kentucky proud, I got lured down to Georgia by a sweet Southern girl who could bake really good.
Oh, sounds like a plan.
What's your question, Chris?
All right. Well, I'm a little embarrassed to ask this one, so you got to bear with me here. So I followed my mom's advice, married a girl who could bake, and boy, does my wife bake great, and she makes a little bit of everything. But I got some questions about frosting, and this is the embarrassing part, is my wife makes some great desserts and makes a couple different frostings that are great, but the thing that always stumps me, and I've expressed this to her, is that the frosting that I love more than anything is actually the canned stuff you can buy
The
grocery store.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe I shouldn't be embarrassed about that, but it's
great.
Don't
be embarrassed.
So she's tried to recreate it a couple times just for events and birthdays because she knows what I like, but hasn't been able to do it. So I guess my question is really, you know, what makes the canned frosting so amazing?
One of the greatest questions ever.
It's super tasty. No, don't be ashamed. One of my favorite snacks, and we were talking about, you know, getting too much sugar in my life, so I don't indulge in this very often, but a can of chocolate frosting and a bag of pretzels, that is a good time. So I think the number one difference between any canned frosting and what your wife is going to make is that they don't taste like butter. And that's a really important flavor profile when you're talking about frosting, because butter is the main ingredient. And you know, your wife may, you know, use some frosting recipes that switch to shortening. And so that could also be a factor. But for the most part, it's butter, because butter has such a unique flavor of its own and a unique melting point. It kind of lingers in your mouth. So when you take a bite of a homemade frosting, it just kind of like – it stays with you. It's got this lingering richness, whereas these canned frostings are based off of, you know, shortening and hydrogenated oils. So they have a really short melting point. So when you put them in your mouth, you taste them, and then they melt away really quickly, really cleanly. And so it doesn't leave that same kind of residue in your mouth. And also they're incredibly creamy. And when you're dealing with a homemade frosting, you know, you have an American-style buttercream where it's just like butter and powdered sugar whipped together, and there's always going to be an inherent grittiness about that you're going to feel on your tongue, and that's going to just subtly set those frostings apart. Meanwhile, a European style buttercream, which is made from like whipped eggs, whether it's whipped egg whites for a Italian or Swiss meringue buttercream, or whether it's whipped yolks for a French buttercream, that's going to add this kind of eggy quality that's going to be there, and a little bit of the silkiness that's just wrong for a canned frosting. They're very creamy, but they're not silken in the same way. So those are the two major differences. And the thing that I do when I want to have like more of a canned frosting style of frosting is I make a German buttercream. And it's not quite the same, but it gets you 95% of the way there.
95% of your way to a canned frosting.
Yeah, to that kind of texture and same mouthfeel. And what it is you start by making a custard, like a pudding, like a vanilla pudding. And then you whip up some butter and then you combine the butter and the custard. And so what that does is the custard, because it's, you know, got milk and eggs and sugar and such in it, it shortens the butter a little bit, if that makes sense. Where because there's these other ingredients involved, the butter doesn't seem quite as rich on your tongue because it's been cut by all these other ingredients. And so it doesn't have the same lingering mouth coating qualities as some other styles of frosting. And because of the eggs and the butter and the custard base to it, it has a little bit more of like a French vanilla flavor, a little bit more of a, it's not as butter forward as some other styles of buttercream can be. And that really helps. But the final trick is if you go to the grocery store in the baking aisle, there's a little flavor bottle called vanilla butternut. And that tastes a lot like frosting to me. If you use just like one micro drop in something, it just has that kind of like je ne sais Betty Crocker to it that tastes like
Betty Crocker.
Whatever it is they put in there. So if you make a German buttercream, and I don't have a recipe on Serious Eats yet. I do have a recipe on my own blog, and maybe we need to cross-pollinate those sometime soon. But if you just Google Brave Tart and German buttercream, you should be able to find that. And that should give you a, you know, a base to leap from. And then doctor with a little vanilla butternut, you can get really close to that canned frosting vibe.
So, Chris, I have a question. Why don't you – is it a matter of pride? Like, why don't you just say to your wife, I love your baking, but could you bring home a can of Duncan Hines or Pillsbury?
Yeah, it's one of those things, that, and I almost feel bad because she takes a lot of pride in her baking and really loves it. And, you know, it's one of those things where – when my birthday or something comes around, she really takes pride in the fact that she made it for me. So the fact that she puts the canned frosting on, I think takes that a little bit away from her. And she's tried. She definitely wants to like make something that I just really love. And so like, if I can, you know, make that happen or help figure that out some of my own too, that seems like a win-win all the way around.
That sounds like some teamwork. I like that.
So do you cheat on her and go to the local diner and get a piece of cake with some canned frosting when she's not looking?
I'm not gonna lie here. One time when she was out of town, I went to the store and actually just bought one of the boxed cake mixes and the canned frosting, and I ate like the whole thing in 3 days.
I respect that.
So maybe you want to encourage your wife to take more business trips.
I think so. I mean, my secret's going to be out when she listens to this. So I'll have to deal with that.
No, I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that we all have these flavor memories that come from the supermarket. And I don't think there's any shame in that. I think that's a really important part for a lot of us of our growing up experience. And I know that when I was a kid, you know, our babysitters would help bake with us. They'd bring, just to keep us busy when they'd come over, they'd bring a box of cake mix and some frosting, and we put that together. And it's just such a fond memory that I don't think there's any reason to throw that under the bus.
And Chris, you should know that Stella's book is actually all about what we're talking about, which is how to make something like a homemade version of an iconic American sweet. But I remember, Stella, you once said to me that you once had a discussion with your brother where your brother was like saying, okay, Stella, just don't make it too good.
Yeah, that's an important.
And so tell Chris about what your point of view is for the book and really for the way you bake.
So my thought and my brother's philosophy about it can't be too good is that you don't want to like overshoot the goal. And that's kind of my problem with some – there's some homemade Oreo recipes out there that use white chocolate for the filling. And it's a delicious cookie. It's, you know, it's fabulous, but it's not an Oreo. An Oreo does not taste like white chocolate. And so there's this, you know, idea that, like, by trying to do a homemade spin on it, that you just kind of miss the spiritual goal, if you will.
Which I love when we get spiritual with Oreos.
Oreos are spiritual, man.
Well, you know, I guess it's that old saying, there's the best flavor is nostalgia, and you don't want to ruin that.
Yeah, exactly. And so you don't want to overshoot that. And so that's why when, you know, you're making a cake at home and you're like, okay, well, then I'll just make this Swiss buttercream. Swiss buttercream is completely delicious and it's my go-to choice for a lot of party cakes, but it's not going to match that texture and flavor that you remember from your childhood. And it's important to acknowledge that. And they don't have to be a substitute for each other. You can find other ways, you know, to make a frosting that hits all those nostalgia points while still satisfying, you know, your desire for homemade. Because there is something special about, you know, being in the kitchen and making something for a loved one and just knowing, like, that's what you're doing. Like, that's why I bake. I bake because I want to give people that feeling. And whether that's my family or, you know, even my own brother, like, for years, I could not get a yellow cake that he thought was up to par for Duncan Hines. So for his birthday every year, I would bake him a Duncan Hines yellow cake because that's what he wanted. And I had to realize that you know, it wasn't really about me. It was about giving him something. But simultaneously, throughout the years, I've been working on a yellow cake recipe until I could get it just to the point where he says, like, yes, this is as tasty as my memory of a boxed cake.
That's awesome.
While also being homemade. So
like, what else have you experimented with? Like Malamars, Fig Newtons, Snickers?
Fig Newtons? Snickers are in the book. That's a good one. I mean, really everything. My only guiding light was that I wanted it to be something that was kind of universal to the American experience. So there's not really any regional cuisine. So there's no like gooey butter cake from San Francisco or San Francisco, St. Louis, excuse me. Or, you know, like even sweet potato pie, which is, you know, very Southern Black America and something that someone growing up in Oregon might not have experienced. So I wanted it to be something that everyone could relate to having a Pop-Tart.
So, yeah, Snickers.
Or a Snickers, something that was kind of, even Malamars, you don't always see them in all regional markets. So I wanted to just stick with things that everyone could agree on. Like, yes, Reese's Cups were a part of my childhood and not like, what's a Reese's Cup?
And your Reese's Cups recipe is pretty amazing.
Thanks.
I have to say.
There's a lot of peanuts
this
in there.
This is one of the best things, Chris, man, is like if you came and got to hang out in the Sirius Eats office when Stella comes and cooks and bakes for a week. First of all, you'd be 25 pounds heavier,
no doubt.
You'd be really, really happy for that week because the smells and the tastes that come – that emanate from the oven, not to mention Stella's stellar presence, it's sort of a magical combination.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Chris, and I hope we've preserved domestic tranquility. That's the key of this phone call.
I think so. Thanks a lot, guys. This is one that was very hard to Google. This has been eye-opening for me, and I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, I hope your wife can check out the German buttercream and see if that style can be a happy medium for the both of you.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, y'all.
All right.
Thanks.
That y'all was like – that was a real y'all.
That was a real y'all.
Did that, like, make you feel like you could be home?
Yeah, that's, like, just 100%. Someone who lives in Kentucky.
So let's talk about the difference between Southern bakers and non-Southern bakers, because that's something that I know you think about because you've had classical training. You went to cooking school.
Mm-hmm.
You've cooked in restaurants that are not necessarily regional American Southern-based restaurants. How do you sort of reconcile those two styles?
I don't know that I do. I think Southern bakers are extremely willing to get some butter into their desserts, and the go-to choice for nut would be a pecan or a pecan. I've always said pecan. I don't. That's where I'm at.
I always thought you know, like that should have been in the Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald. You say pecan and I say pecan.
Right? No, like where the pecan will be like my go-to nut for a recipe. And someone like, oh, this will be great with walnuts. I'm like, get out of here, Yankee. Like, this is ridiculous. Walnuts.
And so you think it's a matter of ingredients, not just style.
I think it's ingredients because, yeah, like any Southern baker is like, yeah, I've got a bag of white lily and some Watkins vanilla in the pantry. And up north, people are like, what are you talking about? Or buttermilk. Oh my gosh. I use buttermilk in so many of my recipes, and then readers will comment like, oh, you know, I can't get buttermilk. What's a good substitute? And I'm just kind of like gripping the edge of my chair. Like, what do you mean you can't? I cannot fathom walking into a grocery store and there not being buttermilk. Like, I just don't understand that universe.
That's funny. And what was it difficult when you went off to culinary school on scholarship and they were mostly delving into classic French pastry techniques? Or was that, wow, bring it on?
It was bring it on. I think at that point, actually, I was slightly ashamed of my heritage. I also, it should be said, people say like, oh, you don't sound that Southern. I've spent a long time, you know, not having a Southern accent, I guess. But when I first went to New York and to culinary school, my nickname was Kentucky, to the extent that all of my knives from culinary school are engraved Kentucky, because my accent was that thick and I was that, you know, Southern in how I presented myself because there was no other me to present. But, you know, after spending a couple of years in New York and after moving to Japan and having all these other life experiences, my accent has really rounded out and it doesn't really come back until I get incredibly sleepy or drunk. And then there it is. But at the time when I was in culinary school, I was really into exploring anything that wasn't Southern because I felt like that's all I knew and that's all that I was. And I was almost like a caricature of that. Oh, hey, Turkey, what's going on? You know, it's like, oh, gosh. And so I just wanted to be not that anymore.
Do you associate sleepy and drunk with being down south or not necessarily?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of sleepy, drunk times down south, I suppose. But that's when I guess, you know, whatever conscious part of my brain that is articulating how to say words gets kind of turned off. I'm like, okay, y'all, it's time for bed, you know, or whatever.
But you know what's interesting is I remember being with this famous French pastry chef, Francois Paillard, at somebody's wedding, at the chef wedding that we both knew, Alex Lee. And Sarah Beth Levine had just won the James Beard Award for Best Pastry Chef. And he just was fuming. And he said to me, he just couldn't stop talking about this at the wedding. He's like, she's not a pastry chef. She's a baker. She makes brownies. And, you know, and it's like, did you have to confront that divide, like that sort of inherent snobbishness between French pastry chefs who are interested in spun sugar and American bakers, which are thought of to be at a sort of lower level of status?
Yeah, I really struggled with that a lot early in my career. Within a couple of years of graduating from culinary school, I was working at a bakery in Midway, Kentucky called Wallace Station. It's owned by Chris and Weta Michael, who are just kind of like the pillars of Kentucky cuisine. And they own the Holly Hill Inn and some other restaurants, Smithtown Seafood in the area that just really are the corner of our local cuisine. And I've worked off and on with them for years. And so I was at Wallace Station, and it was this cute, precious little bakery in the middle of nowhere. And I helped them open it, and I thought it was going to be this kind of like just a really kind of nice break. I was coming from high-end restaurant work at the time, and I was just like ready to be like, all right, I'm going to make some muffins. I'm going to make some brownies. Going to make some, you know, little quiches. It's going to be great. Just like sleepy little town. Like, here we go. And it was insane. It was like nonstop customers all day long from sunup to sundown. I was getting there at like 4 o'clock in the morning and just like baking my ass off and just like going crazy, making all this stuff. And it was selling faster than I could bake it. It was selling faster than anyone could bake it because of our limited kitchen space. And that was when I had my quarter life crisis that I say, where I was just like, I have gone to culinary school. I have, you know, studied with the best. I have worked in high-end restaurants. I am living in Lexington, Kentucky, baking brownies every day like I did when I was 10. And at the time, I really resented it. I was just like, what? Why did I go to culinary school just to make brownies and muffins all day? This is
ridiculous.
Not only
am I running in place, I'm going backwards.
Yeah. So I, at the time, I didn't really feel like I was progressing. And what I didn't realize then and what I know now is that I was just, A, learning the valuable lesson of the restaurant business about the kind of work that it takes to, you know, output those desserts for people and production and things like that. But that's when I like cashed out my life savings and moved to Japan. I was like, I need a different direction in my life.
You went radical.
I went radical. Yeah. I was like, I'm out of here. But, you know, coming back around and really what led to the book is realizing that there is nothing to be ashamed of in these desserts. And there is no reason that they shouldn't be treated with respect. Because what's the difference between a brownie and a flourless chocolate cake or a French tort?
Like, right.
Very little. There is very little difference.
Just the name.
One is round.
Absolutely. So I'm Ed Levine, and you're listening to Call Special Sauce, and I'm here with the Brave Tart, our pastry wizard at Serious Eats, Stella Parks. And we've got our next caller on the line, Stella.
Excellent.
Hi, Stephanie. How are you? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Ed. It's so awesome to talk to you. I am calling from New Jersey.
Hey, Stephanie.
Hey, Stella.
What's on your mind?
So I started thinking about this the other day, and then I wanted to kind of – I was going to send Stella a tweet, but this is even better. Every year I have, like, lofty goals. I make, like, a list of, like, 10 or 15 different cookies that I want to put on a platter for Christmas, and I maybe get to, like, two or three of them because
– We have to invite Stephanie to the Serious Eats cookie swap, don't we?
Oh, yeah. I've never done the cookie swap before.
Yeah, and this will be Stella's first cookie swap. So it's Stella, you, and Stephanie. It's a cookie swap that we do every year. It's an old-fashioned cookie swap with all the people that we work with, and everyone brings cookies, and then we bring them boxes – And everyone gets to take home a box of other people's cookies. So,
Guys,
Stephanie, you're in.
I'd love to. Oh, my gosh, that'd be amazing.
Yes.
So, anyway, my question really is there a way that I can maybe start in advance? And are there, like, doughs that are better for freezing raw? Can I freeze already baked cookies? And, like, what are some strategies for, like, how I can do this in advance without, like, you know, not cleaning my house and not feeding my husband for, like, the week leading up to Christmas?
There's a lot of really good ways to do that. And in all my experience as a pastry chef, I've always been a one-woman operation. So I've never had, like, the team of minions to, like, help me do things. So I really feel for that. Like, how do you accomplish all of these different, like, products and diversity and still do everything else? And so there, first of all, cookies are so friendly to make ahead techniques. And a large part is, or at least the way I make my cookie dough, and this is a simple technique you can adapt to your recipe, is a lot of recipes have you, you know, mix any kind of baking powder and baking soda in with the flour. I add them with the sugar and butter so that they're creamed together up front. And that has a somewhat waterproofing effect on the leavening agents. And that prevents the chemical reaction that creates leavening from kicking in too early, just from the moisture of the batter. And that's a huge step right there if you're going to make some kind of just – and this is for any recipe that's a classic creaming the butter and sugar cookie. If it involves melted butter, it wouldn't work. But so add the leavening agents up front when you cream the butter and sugar. And then the dough is going to hold much better in their fridge or freezer because you're not going to have any, like, loss of reaction. And you can just refrigerate the dough pre-portioned or in a tube if it's a slice-and-bake kind of cookie. And that keeps really well. And freezing is no problem for cookie doughs. You can make them whether it's a slice-and-bake if you're making a log and you want to freeze it, or if you want to freeze the dough, I portion everything up first. When the dough is, like, soft, I'll, like, you know, put a sheet of wax paper on a cutting board, scoop out the dough in 1-ounce portions or, you know, whatever the recipe calls for, pop it in the freezer for, like, 10 or 15 minutes until the dough is really firm, and then just throw it in a bag. And you just want to make sure it's sealed really well so that you don't get, you know, any kind of freezer burn going on there. And so those are all good make-ahead techniques for cookies that involve creaming the butter and sugar or that are traditional, like, scoop, drop-and-bake cookie or a slice-and-bake cookie. And for other kind of cookies that, whether it's like a biscotti or a meringue, it's kind of the challenge is to find a mix of recipes that hit these different techniques. So if you're going to do this kind of make-ahead cookie platter.
Wait, before we move to that one, Stephanie, does that work for you in terms of freezing? Did you get what you needed?
Yeah. I mean, I think that kind of covers the basics. I mean, the tip with the leavening agents is definitely something I'm going to try. I like the idea of that. Most of the stuff I usually do is, like, a more traditional, like, creaming method type cookies. So That I think that will help a lot.
Yeah.
So thanks.
So, look, I'm a little annoyed at your husband, Stephanie, because you make it sound like his expectations are so high. I mean, let him go to Burger King or something during the holidays. You know, it's like he could get a cookie there and take some of the pressure off you.
See, it's not his expectations that are high. Uh-huh. They are certainly my own. He would be more than happy with a package of ramen or a box of mac and cheese and his video games. Like, he is perfectly
Uh-oh, video games.
With that.
Stella and John, her husband, total video game fanatics. Video game fanatics.
I was wondering if Stella would recognize that the name of my cat is Cadillac. And it's from Chrono Trigger from the Super Nintendo days.
Oh, my gosh. John is obsessed with that game. I have not played myself, but I've certainly spent many hours on the couch watching as John. He loves old school games, like, mm-hmm. so intensely.
You would love my den.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Stephanie, we have to do a home and home. You're going to come to the cookie swap. We're going to come to your den when next time Stella's in town. So I'm sorry, Stella, I'd interrupted about the next style of cookie.
Oh, so, I mean, it's you want to make sure there's a good mix of techniques that are going to fit your schedule. You know, sometimes if someone has some ideas of a cookies that they want to do for a box and you look, you're like, well, these are all, like, extremely last-minute techniques. Whatever the specific recipe is, like maybe like they want to make some Florentines that are going to involve, you know, some stovetop time and some oven time and some chocolate tempering, and they're going to want to do meringues and all this stuff. And they end up picking like a lot of like really intense techniques, and you're like, you need to balance this out with some like more low key cookies also. But it sounds like you've got a good mix of, or like a good foundation of classic cookies that are like creaming method cookies. And those are going to be really friendly, like I said, for doing the doughs, which may free you up to be able to like bake off some meringues, which you could do, you know, as the last thing you do before bed and let them dry out in the oven overnight. Like little meringue kisses or drop cookies like that, mm-hmm. or little meringue mm-hmm. mushrooms, which are, I think, a really cute addition to any kind of holiday cookie assortment. Things like that kind of help. Or I always say this is the time to avoid new techniques. So if you haven't really, you know, gotten into like macaroon making, I wouldn't say like now's the time.
So how many cookies do you tend to make around holiday time, Stephanie?
Many, many dozen is probably the best estimation I could give you. Now, a large portion of my effort during the holidays is actually spent on the traditional Hungarian cookies that my grandmother used to make. They're called kiffles. I'm not sure you guys have ever heard of them, but they're like a pastry-like dough that you cut into squares and then fill with we use walnuts. And it's like a kind of like a pasty sort of walnut and sugar and egg white mixture. Then you roll up the little tacos and bake them off. Those are like a whole day's worth of work to, you know, make the dough, roll them out, cut them up individually, and then fill and bake. So that is a big part of what I do. And if I ever actually participate in this cookie swap, I would absolutely bring those because they are a hugely, hugely popular cookie that I will always bring places, and people seem to love them.
So you roll them out. Do you mean you roll them out sort of ruglock, like which is also a Hungarian cookie?
Yeah, it's similar to that, except that they're not like spiral like that, where it's just like I'll put like a knob of this like ground walnut mixture in the middle and make like a taco out of it. And maybe more like a burrito.
Got it.
that sounds really tasty.
Yeah, they're good. The dough is crazy, though. It has no sugar in it. So the only sugar is you mix 50-50 flour and sugar on the board when you roll them out.
Okay.
So it's just sugar on the outside and sugar in the filling and sugar in the dough.
Before we go, Stephanie, I wanted to ask Stella, what cookies do you make for holiday season?
I've been working on my book for the last 5 years of my life. So it is for the last 5 years that it's been a mix of Oreos and Nutter Butters and Fig Newtons and things like that. So there are a lot of filled cookies. But another thing that you can do that is just occurring to me to explain a little bit more is if you've got any kind of assembly cookie like that, the filling could be made in advance, you know, whatever your ground up mixture is, like knock that out the night before and have that like in a bowl, or it could be pre-portioned to do that. Even some recipes that I have that involve like rolling and cutting out the dough, sometimes I'll roll out a bunch of sheets of dough and stack them on a half sheet pan, and then wrap it up and stick it in the fridge overnight. And then the next day I can just like get to cutting, and my kitchen's not.
Why have
that.
I never thought of that?
It
depends. This is why she's the brilliant brave tart, Stephanie. Yeah.
It depends on having, you know, enough space in the fridge to house a sheet pan with dough stacked up on it. That can be really helpful because sometimes it's the cleanup part that makes it so intensive. So if you can, you know, you make the dough and roll it out and kind of destroy your kitchen all in one go, and then, you know, save the cutting and decorating baking phase for another time, can be a helpful approach.
So Stephanie, I hope we have solved your cookie in advance problem, your cleaning problems, and whatever husband problems you happen to be having as they relate to your cookies. Anyway, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much, guys. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye.
Well, Stella Parks, Brave Tart, our pastry wizard, thank you so much for answering so many people's questions, because the holidays are filled with baking questions.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Well, thank you for sharing your baking special sauce with us on this special call, special sauce.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time. And that's it.